You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. And today we're going to talk about cultural revolution. But before we get to today's Pathways show, I want to take a moment to thank everyone who's supported our Camp KBOO Summer Membership Drive. KBOO is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you, and together we can keep the station alive and thriving for many years to come. It's been 56 years and counting, but now we need your support to continue bringing you the grassroots, independent, and one-of-a-kind voices from your community and beyond. Help us reach our $50,000 fundraising goal by making a donation today at kboo.fm/give. And we thank you for your support. Our world is full of people who are hungry for a meaningful existence, but who only find the junk food of commercialism. Today's guest says that there's plenty of good, nutritious food for our souls if we learn how to look for it. Our guest today is Alan Hunter, author of the book Spiritual Hunger, Integrating Myth and Ritual into Daily Life. Alan has a doctorate in English literature from Oxford University. He's been a professor of literature at Curry College and has taught at Boston University and Bay Path University. He has spent 30 years exploring the way literature has been vital in helping us to explain ourselves to ourselves. He has a coaching practice and has written many books, always a brilliant read, and has been a guest on Pathways a few times before. And I always enjoy our conversation and get a lot out of it, and I'm sure you will too. Hello, Alan, and welcome to the Pathways show.
Hello, Paolo. It's really delightful to be with you again, and I do enjoy our conversations. So this is always good fun for me.
Okay, well, let's start by defining the title of your book, A Spiritual Hunger. What is that? What do you mean by that?
Spiritual hunger is precisely what it says, and that is many of us here in the West are pining for some sort of nourishment, some sort of spiritual nourishment that will give us a purpose we can believe in and a life we can believe in. And I say this because in my counseling practice and talking with my colleagues, what I discover again and again is people who are coming to me who have been unable to find anything vital that they can believe in. Or perhaps they found something they can devote their energy to, but they know that it is too small for who they are, that they are spending their time obsessing perhaps over how to have the perfect do-over of their kitchen.
Okay. And today we're going to talk about mythology. And I suspect that half the reason people have trouble having anything to believe in is that they don't believe in our cultural myths, some of which are so fantastical. But you You give us a whole different perspective on this, on how to interpret mythology, and that's this book is a really interesting read about that. Okay, so we have this desire to live in a world that is significant. And what's the way out of this spiritual starvation?
Spiritual starvation is, in fact, very easy to cure, but we have to look deeper at some of the things that we accept as cultural myths and cultural rituals. Because what's happened is some of our rituals have become stale and stuck. I will give you a particular example here, and that is around about where I live, there are many, many bride and bridal accoutrement shops. And so there are lots of people who go to these places to plan their weddings. Wonderful. And yet, as we know from shows like Bridezillas, which was a few years back, we know that sometimes the focus has moved from what the meaning is in the process, and it's moved to an obsession about the flowers, the locale, the type of dress, who's going to do what, the music, that. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have a nice wedding. Wonderful weddings are wonderful weddings, and they keep on going, keep on happening. What I'm saying is that if we choose to, if we wish to look for a moment or two at the structure of the quote traditional wedding, what we can see is that there is a reverence for what happens beyond that first day of party and frivolity and throwing the bouquet over the shoulder so the bridesmaids can fight for it. There is something very, very important going on. Our ancestors knew this. They knew it from the moment that they had the family of the groom on one side of the church or the temple, and the family of the bride on the other side of the church and the temple. And I want us to focus on that. Because what that says is that when these two people marry, they're not just marrying each other, bang, that's it. They're actually marrying into a whole set of connections of people, some of whom they haven't met yet, all of whom have opinions, all of whom could be supportive or could be very unsupportive. And it's mirrored there in the ritual of the classic wedding that we are all so familiar with from the TV, even if we haven't gone to a lot of weddings ourselves. This is a way that it was signaled to us that these two people have come to whatever arrangement they've come to. Whether we believe in it or not is not up to us. They believe in it, but they're also part of a whole structure that seeks to hold them and hold them responsible. Now, when we read about weddings in the news, especially celebrity weddings, we rarely hear about anything particularly to do with the family, apart from when the divorce happens and one of the children is, or two of the children, or whatever, is unhappy. But it's always seen, especially in our popular press, as star A marries star B. Isn't that wonderful? Yes, it is wonderful. Love is a wonderful thing. But we're forgetting in this focus, we're forgetting the mythic background of, well, families melding together, having to get on with each other. What happens if they don't get on? What happens if they do get on? Who's going to support the children?
Okay, you're talking about a ritual, the marriage ritual that has a mythic context that goes back to the beginning of, I don't know, civilization, I guess. But that we're not really we're just kind of missing out on that, although it's probably one of the more, as you point out in your book, it's one of the more alive rituals that we still have. Because there's so many others that that are empty. And so you're talking about how to choose to see the world mythically, and that's kind of that's a solution that you're offering to the problem of despair and the effort to find deeper meaning in your life. And it's interesting that you bring up the marriage ritual, because as you say in the book, and I'm going to quote you, in the West, we tend to look for meaning through our attachment to others, rather than locations or the spirit of the land. And romantic love is held as the highest achievement.
Yes.
Wow.
Thank
that's so interesting, you know, because no wonder the mythic resonance of the marriage ritual is lost, because we're so focused on this romantic paradigm of, you know, meeting the right person and being fixed for life. I think that kind of sucks the meaning out of it, because it's really kind of a superficial way to look at it.
Absolutely. You've put it beautifully. We're focusing on the wrong thing. We're focusing on what Hollywood has told us to focus on in its rom-coms. And there's no shortage of rom-coms. They're still making them. Romantic comedies, the hero meets the heroine, they get together eventually. It all ends happily. Wait, they get together, and that's when things start to get interesting. How will they manage the fact that they spend all this time not being able to come to some sort of arrangement that
right.
is standing?
Yeah, and you say, you're right, and I love this. The therapist, you say the people that are wealthy, they live as if they can dispense with the deeper meaning of events, because they can buy whatever they want, or they can, you know, distract themselves endlessly. And you say the therapist couches of the world are filled with wealthy neurotics looking for meaning and purposes they can believe in.
Yes.
This is a crisis. You know, you call it spiritual hunger. And do you think it's worse in the United States than in other parts of the world?
Alas, I actually do think it's very much worse in the United States. And I can say that perhaps as a person who was brought up in England and has traveled the world. And the reason for that is that we have so many bright, shiny toys to distract us. We have so many things that can keep us reaching for what we think is fulfillment, which may turn out to be hollow. So the psychiatrist's couches and my practice are full of people who have paid their dues and tried hard, and they've moved up through the organization, and they've finally got that promotion, and it feels empty. And unfortunately, they've been bending their considerable will and considerable talent for something that is bound to be empty, because it's out there. It's not inside here. It's not a sense of personal achievement that is in tune with the universe. Often it's a sense of personal achievement that is achieved at someone else's expense. So I got the promotion. I'm better than everybody else. Let me think about that. That means that basically everyone else is being trashed in that conversation. Ah, I have more money. I can buy whatever I want. Okay. How does that make you feel connected to this great, wide, beautiful world and all the many people in it who are different? Well, it doesn't. It isolates us. Bad myths isolate.
You know, you bring up the point that the ego is kind of the enemy of meaning to some extent, because it's so goal-oriented and it's so objectifying. And you say if a culture doesn't have a viable mythology, it will invent its own. And that's what we're witnessing right now. And you distinguish between real myth and commercial myth. Can you speak to that for us?
Yes, as I was saying just a moment ago, real myth unites us to our fellow human beings, to nature, to the bigness of our wonderful world. Bogus myth isolates us, which is why I have a problem at the moment with those people who focus on the idea of winning. And there is, you know, no matter what your politics are, I think we can say there's one politician who is determined, he's going to win, it's going to win, 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 win. Yes, but if that winning is at the expense of human relationship, of connection with others, of love, then I don't think that's a winning that's worth having. I think that there's something else that is more important.
Yeah.
When human beings in a marriage, say, we were just talking about marriage, you know, it's the husband doesn't say, I'm going to win in this marriage, I'm going to win. And the wife doesn't say, I'm going to make sure I win it, because that's the way of misery. What they do, if they're sensible,
that's the road to divorce for sure.
Divorce. If they're sensible, they say, okay, how can we both work together so that we get what we need from each other and from the world in a peaceful way that doesn't seek to dominate or denigrate or in any way look down on the other person?
Okay, so we have all these myths that we've had for centuries, and some of which never end, you know, like the myth of the resurrection or the, you know, whatever. People believe in these things for thousands of years, even though rationally they know that's, you know, not what happened, but they still believe in that. Isn't that a problem? I mean, if we believe in things that are unbelievable, doesn't that lend us to conspiracy theories or any number of ridiculous notions?
It does. It really does. And conspiracy theories are rampant out there. You know, we know that. The point, I think, is best made by one of the Nobel mathematics winners from India, whose name I cannot pronounce, but he went on record as saying that, yes, he won the Nobel Prize for mathematics. So, yeah, he's good at this. But in his private life, he's a Hindu. And so he was asked, well, do you believe that the entire universe is supported on the back of a giant turtle that is swimming through it? And he says, no, but I'm still a devout Hindu. And I think, oh, this is the difference. We can have a myth and recognize that it's trying to tell us something which might not necessarily be true in itself, but leads us towards the truth. So the, you know, the Jesus story or any religious story really is almost certainly not documentary truth, but it may give us some insight into the nature of the way we function in our world. The Jesus story is a particularly powerful one, of course.
But isn't that giving too much credit for the people who write these stories in the first place? I mean, they're not necessarily enlightened. You know, I appreciate what you're doing in this book, which is saying, hey, we have perfectly serviceable myths, some of which have been around for a long time, if we just know how to tap into them, if we just know how to connect and appreciate them for what they are, rather than trying, you know, to get super literal about it. But I question things, you know, it's like I have this, I want truth. You know, it's sort of like I want to believe in things that are true. Now, the myth of Daedalus obviously is not a true story. Okay, I can really appreciate that. But what bothers me, having been brought up in a fundamentalist culture, is where I've had these myths shoved down my throat as literal truth, and that sort of destroys their ability to inspire me.
Yes.
And to accept them.
Yes, that's exactly it. If we regard them as literal truth, what we've got is basically old news about things that we can't believe. Oh, there was a flood and Noah was in it. Oh, great. So what? You know, there was a man called Jesus and he was crucified. Oh, great. So what? But let's take, for instance, the myth of Daedalus, which is older, of course, a very old myth. Daedalus and Icarus, the father-son duo, they are imprisoned, according to the myth, and they create these wings of wax and feathers that enable them to fly out of captivity. Wonderful. So it's already a myth about human inventiveness, even if you couldn't possibly believe that 4,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago, people were flying this way.
Right.
And according to the story, they fly, and Icarus flies too close to the sun, despite having been warned not to. His wings melt, he plunges into the sea and dies. And you think, okay, if you're like my old school teachers, they'd say, and that's why you shouldn't try to overstep your mark, young man. yeah, okay, but behind it, there's something really important. Imagine what the father feels as he sees the son, the teenage son, plunging into the water. He's invented those wings. He's given them to his son, knowing that his son is not responsible, and he watches his son fall and drown. Imagine what that says. Now, on a personal level, that speaks to me as those parents who give their parents, perhaps give their children, the keys to the car.
Right.
And, you know, the kid wrecks it and maybe doesn't survive. Or those parents who alarmingly give their kid, without instruction, access to weapons, guns. And the kid is not able to handle that responsibility. And I'm saying here, this is a myth for a whole society which says, doesn't matter how inventive you are, let's think about whether we're ready for it. Now, the big discussion today is, of course, AI, especially in academic circles. You know, what will artificial intelligence do? We'll have computers writing our papers, blah, 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 blah. And I'm saying it's a prime example. We've invented something and we haven't thought out yet how dangerous or good it is. And it's right there in the myth of Daedalus and Icarus, all those 3,000 years ago, which is roughly when it was...
What sort of myths do we need? You mentioned Joseph Campbell as suggesting that we will have new myths that are created by the poets of our time. And you say, it's a charming notion, but not one that I feel is accurate. And so, you know, is this why you're energizing a deeper understanding of the myths that we already have? And, you know, is Joseph Campbell suggesting that we should have new myths that are more accurate or something?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, I have yet to see something that convinces me as a modern mythology that that will give us what we need. I have, however, witnessed in the past mythologies and past rituals, come to that, the sort of nutrition that we need to keep us from spiritual hunger if we look for it. The thing is, we're out of practice of looking for it and at it, and so it can't feed us. Like that old adage of the men who are navigating their boat, their ship up the Amazon River, and they met another ship coming the other way, and the first ship said, "Help, we have no water." And the second ship said, "Well, have you tried lowering your bucket over the side?" The first ship hadn't realized they were still in a river. They thought that because it was so big, they were in an ocean and it was salt water.
Right.
We're in the same situation,
right.
Which is why in that book I spend so much time looking at past myths and saying, perhaps there's something here that they can tell us.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And how do rituals relate to myths? Your book is about myths and rituals. What's the relationship?
Yes. Rituals are actions that you do, and they contain, if you're lucky, an emotional component that makes them memorable. So you do the ritual and it moves you, and you know something's happened. Myth is where you begin to tell the story or find the story behind the action. And when you find the story, you can put your feelings into words and understand it better.
Can you give some examples of how present-day rituals have become hollowed out?
Yes. Well, I've given the example of weddings, marriages. The example of Daedalus and Icarus, of course, also applies to how we teach or don't teach children and young adults about responsibility. Motor deaths still claim a huge number of children, I should say young adults, but under the age of 21 every year, because they haven't been taken through that sense of here is power to use it responsibly. Another myth perhaps would be any of the stories around Bacchus and the gods of wine. Now, I worked at a college, and every year the ambulances would come because some kid had drunk too much and was near death or in a coma and needed to be pumped out every year. And yet we know from the myths that surround Bacchus and the wine gods that the rituals concerned were famously outrageous. And they were outrageous because the clear message was, this stuff, alcohol, is powerful. In fact, it's more powerful than you or me.
Right.
So use it carefully.
Yeah.
It can be wonderful. It can also be too powerful.
You speaking of ritual, and you say there needs to be a strong emotion for it to be effective. You do make an exception, and you say, but pain can serve. And you're whether this lies behind the current enthusiasm for getting tattoos. And I found that fascinating because I've been wondering about that myself for a long time. I don't get it. So can you explain your theory about tattoos and how that relates to ritual, through pain?
Well, pain is a very good way of remembering something. We remember the event, we have emotions about the event, and tattooing, ritual tattooing, is as old as humanity. We've certainly got evidence, some evidence, that ancient forebears tattooed their skins for various reasons. Clearly, this was painful. This was a memorable thing. It had some meaning to them. Now, when I have a tattoo parlor at the end of my street, actually, and when I walk past it, I see these often young people, but often my age people as well, wonderfully adorned with magnificent tattoos. And I'm saying, that cost a lot of money and a lot of pain.
You know
Are
what
you
I say? I say to them, I say, you know, that's never going to come off. And they love it. You know, there's so much more we could explore. I can't believe that we have already run out of time for today. Oh, man. I hope that people read your book because it's so fulfilling and it meant so much to me. And I'm going to read it again. But I want to thank you, Alan, for being with us today. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is AlanHunter.net. That's Alan spelled with two L's, Allan Hunter.net. And thanks again, Alan, for being with us today.
Hello, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you, and we could have talked for a lot longer, but this is great. Thank you.
We'll do it again.
Good.
And for those who may have tuned into Pathways late today, this is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, don't worry, you can play and/or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Alan Hunter, author of Spiritual Hunger: Integrating Myth and Ritual into Daily Life. What a practical book. I hope everybody goes out and gets a copy and reads it. And I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. Or perhaps you subscribe to the podcast version for free, which you can find at divination.com, that's divination.com, as well as on Pathways Radio on Paulo's YouTube channel, where if you like our conversations, you can give us a thumbs up and subscribe. And please feel free to forward a link to your friends. Now, before I close the show this week, remember that we're in the middle of our Camp KBOO summer drive. You can donate by going to kbOO.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Our members make KBOO possible, so please make a contribution. Your donation is tax deductible, but more importantly, it feels good to be a contributor and not just a consumer. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for listening to volunteer-powered, community-supported KBOO Portland. And this is Paulo bidding you adieu and reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Podcasts. And thanks again to Alan Hunter and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Thank you. You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, on Friday, June 27th at 11 a.m.